Welcome to the podcast for Boomer Women, where we are embracing the journey. I'm your host, Agnes Knowles. I hope you enjoy this conversation today as much as I did. Within minutes of meeting Don, I felt like I was having coffee, or in his case, a chai latte, with an old friend. It was comfortable, it was meandering, and we followed it wherever it went. Mostly, we followed the premise of his new book, The Afterwork: Finding Fulfilling Alternatives to Retirement. But like most good conversations, we did go sideways on several occasions. Whether reminding us we are done now with the main pieces of adulting, or that we have the gift of 20 to 30 extra years post-career, I liked his observations. And I always enjoy personal anecdotes. As you know, I always ask my guests a personal question before we close. My question of Don today was a bit impertinent, but I appreciate his answer and the chat that ensued. Listen now to my conversation with Don Auction. The afterwork. That term is so much better than my phrase of post 9 to 5, and probably more accurate as so many people leaving the 9 to 5 are looking for more than, as my guest says, non-stop leisure. He calls it the piña colada fever dream. Don says it's probably out of reach for most Americans, and I'll extend that to us Canadians too, as well as a waste of 20 to 30 extra years post-career that we've been gifted by longer lifespans. He posits that the afterwork years can be ideal for starting a new business, following a creative pursuit, volunteering, or working part-time in a whole new field. But above all, it's a new beginning rather than the beginning of the end. As I look back over 5 years of interviewing for this podcast, I know that no one has ever promoted TV in a rocking chair as the ideal way to spend their time after they leave their career. So let's meet today's guest, Don. Okay, I got to do this. Don Auction, is that right?
That's it.
Close enough. I should have changed it here too. Welcome to the podcast for Boomer Women, where we are embracing the journey.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on in spite of my Y chromosome.
That's okay. Well, there's been more than a few of you.
Okay.
As long as you got something to offer, you're welcome here. Dear. Don, we're going to get to the after work shortly, but tell us about the work part of your life.
The part that I left behind.
Yeah.
Okay. I was bent on becoming a journalist from the time I was about 12. And I became one. I went to college, got a degree in journalism. I became one, worked for a newspaper for about 3 years. And by that point, I felt like I'd been in the business for 13 because I'd been wishing for it so long. And it also was a little disappointing to me because I'd had higher expectations for ethics than I found in the business. I left that. I became a magazine editor and writer, which I liked quite a bit. Left that because of, I can't remember why. Yes, I do, because my wife was ready for her turn, because we were trying to juggle two careers. And so we had a brief sojourn in another city which shall remain nameless, but had a record low snowfall of only 40 inches, and it was enough to break me. So we moved to Baltimore, Maryland, which is a lovely mid-Atlantic city, not too intimidating in size, but still urban and has all the right urban amenities. And we've been here for 40 years and we like it very much. And I shifted my career into marketing communications, which meant I was writing now for corporations and nonprofit organizations, things like annual reports and brochures and newsletters. Did that for companies and sometimes on my own. In between, I had stints as a marketing director at a community college and then a university and then a foundation. And again, turned back to working for myself until I reached the point at which I could collect Social Security. And I said, hooray, I made it. It's time to have my endless summer vacation, which did not turn out to be an endless summer vacation as it happens.
Okay, first of all, I gotta say that there's a reason I live on the west coast of Canada because I'm one of those people that stay home after 4 inches of snow. It's like partly because they're all crazy. The drivers out here are crazy. I have driven in severe weatherish times, but yeah, but you can keep your 40 inches. Thank you kindly. Now, on your website, it says, your career path was littered with potholes and zigzags until he discovered his own life purpose in the afterwork. It sounds like your afterwork is far more rewarding than the work part.
Absolutely. But I have to say, I didn't get to it immediately. And part of the inspiration for writing the book was the fact that it didn't come easily for me. And I suspect it's a difficult transition for many others. And I wanted to do something about how my experience had changed me. When I first retired, like I said, I was looking for the eternal summer vacation where I could do what I really wanted to do, which was write fiction. I had been afflicted with a serious case of authoritis since about the age of 7, and so to me, writing a book was the perfect thing to do. And I did for 4 years. I wrote two books in 4 years, and I discovered that it was not the life that I expected. First of all, they never got published. So there was, 60 to 100 rejections papering my walls. But second, when you write a book and you spend 2 years on it, it's very difficult to get any feedback along the way. I could show it to my wife, but I wasn't sure if she would just say nice things because she doesn't want me to be grumpy or would be too critical and make me really angry. So I didn't have any feedback for 2 years, and I on each book, and that was difficult. At the end of 4 years, I thought I've got to do something different, and I signed up to be part of a group that was international, a creative coach who was on the internet and was forming a group of creative people, and invited me to join, and I said, "This sounds great. It's like a feedback group. Plus, I'll be getting some inspiration and some lessons on being more creative." So I joined that, and it was just what I needed because in a couple of months, the idea was suggested, "Well, why don't you write shorter stuff?" Duh, why didn't I think of that? So about that time, I also noticed that there was a program called Substack, which was perfect for people who wanted to write newsletters. And I thought, okay, I'll write a weekly newsletter about my aging experience with a positive spin, because I had gone from being kind of negative about aging to being very positive about it over this time. And so that's what I did. For a little more than 4 years ago, I started writing a weekly column. For a time, I added a podcast, but it got to be too much, and I dropped that after a couple of years. But I still write a weekly column, and that also inspired me to look deeper into the whole issue of retirement. And that's where I came to write the afterwork. And I know it's more appealing than the name you came up with, but the reason I came up with it was because I don't think retirement as we've known it is a very worthwhile goal because our lives have changed so much. And I'm going to stop talking because I'm talking too much.
No, not at all. I'll go back to your basic premise, which was that we're now living 20, 30, 40 years longer than our grandparents did. As I was prepping my notes, everybody knows I come with notes, I was thinking that one of the quickest ways to eliminating those extra decades would to be go feet up in front of the TV on a daily basis.
Absolutely.
So, yeah. Now, in your book, actually, one more question. Where did the piña colada fever dream come from?
To me, that was just a descriptor for what I see advertised as retirement life on television or in magazines. It's the perfect, It's the perfect life. And perhaps you can enjoy that if you happen to choose to live your life in one of the Margaritaville senior villages. But to me, it seemed like a tremendous waste of time and also financially unfeasible for 90% of Americans.
I've seen those ads and I have my own opinions about them. We won't go there. Now we'll go back to the book. It's called The Afterwork: Finding Fulfilling Alternatives to Retirement. Now, I really appreciate the fact that you remind us that our adulting obligations are over and done with. You know, we've been the son or daughter, we've been the spouse, we've been the parent, we've been the worker bee. But it can be a hard transition to accept, to get our heads around.
Yes, very definitely. It was hard for me. I think it's harder even for people who have focused very exclusively on their career for 40 years. And then they have the retirement party, and the next day they find that there's this huge hole in their life where work used to be. And they're thinking, what now? What's my identity? And they start missing things like, well, who's going to make the coffee? Well, who's going to Xerox for me? I've never managed my own email. How do I do that? And it's a different world. Even more to the point, I interviewed someone from the book for the book who was a department head in a college. And he says, you know, when I worked there, people gave me, respect, I was deference, and I thought it was just because of me and my nice guy personality and my easy to work with. When I left that and was on my own, I was amazed at how little deference I got, how much I became a nothing, a nobody. And it comes as a shock to a lot of people. So it does become a difficult transition. According to what I have read, it is generally harder for men than it is for women. But of course, if we have ambitious, career-driven women, it's the same problem for many of them. And it's not dissimilar from the problem that women experience when they've given their lives to raising children and then they have an empty nest. Again, there's this emptiness of this and this, what do I do now?
Yeah, the one thought that caught my attention there was the fact that this person thought they had become a nobody, whereas I would see it more of they've just become anybody. There was just no difference between them and the next person, you know. So it's just, but identity is so huge. And I will say this, sorry, I'll let you talk in a minute. is that the tail end of my career. I mean, I'd been management, I'd been all sorts of things. I ended up as I'll say the receptionist, the front door person. So I was answering the phones, I was directing people, I was greeting people. When I left that position, it wasn't anything fabulous. I was probably one of the lowest paid people in the building. But the social contact, the fun, that part of my identity, the problem solver, was what I had to adjust to. So it's not just even the high-flying executive or the person with a lot of responsibility and respect. It's, you know, whatever you've been doing for a lot of years can become your identity.
Yeah, if you have work friends, and then you leave work, if you're really, really good at connection, you might be able to keep up with them. But you have to face the fact that you stepped off the train and the train is still moving to the next stop, taking all of your former work friends with them, and you're going to have a lot less to talk about. Things keep changing and you're no longer a part of them. And that makes it a little bit of a strain.
I'll hazard a guess there too, just from one thing that did happen to me when I was wrapping up and people knew I was leaving. And of course, what are you going to do next? Well, I'd already gone online. I was starting to get excited about a few things. And a few people who weren't really happy at that 9 to 5, They sort of sigh and say, "Well, that's all right for you, Agnes. You're brave that way. And you don't mind taking risks." And I'm thinking, well, possibly personality is a part of that, but also the drive for something different, better, however you define better, has got to be a part of moving on.
Well, I think almost everyone is going to have to do some reinvention at the point when they leave their career. And that's kind of what the afterwork is all about. It's because we have these longer lives, it has really changed everything. When the retirement systems, national retirement systems were put into place, life expectancy was in the mid 50s, and the retirement age was set at 65. And not a lot of people made it to 65. And those that did didn't have many years of retirement to enjoy. What we have now is if you retire at 65, you're probably looking at 25 or 30 more years. And that is entirely too long to spend in the pina colada fever dream. You've got to do something else. And I do see it as a great opportunity to do something else. It's a real chance to fish out your childhood ambitions and the paths not taken for one reason or another and try them out. And if you don't succeed, not to worry. Nobody's counting on you. It doesn't matter. You're not going to fall off a cliff. Try something else till you find something that really brings you joy and do that. And I suggest lots of options and give examples of people who have done that, just that.
Perfect segue. In my intro, I used your words, starting a new business, or your suggestions, starting a new business, following a creative pursuit, volunteering, or working part-time in a whole new field. Now, do you come up with suggestions, or do people just seem to know where their heart lies?
I happen to be a person who's very introspective, and I spend a lot of time analyzing myself. Not everyone is built that way. Some people find it so difficult to do that they avoid it their entire lives. So no, it's not easy for those people. And that's why retirement coaches are such a great idea, because they can get you thinking in a different way and help you ferret out, what is what really drives you and what your real self is all about, and help you discover what would bring you joy in this new stage of life.
So you interviewed people for your book. How did you
I
find them?
did. A lot of it was word of mouth. I because I have a subscription newsletter, I put a call out there for my subscribers, but a lot of it was friends who then told other friends who knew other people. And until I had a fairly diverse group of about 50 people from different income strata and different demographics and different parts of the country.
With the people that you interviewed, were there any after work paths that more people prioritized over others?
No. What is most amazing about this is that everyone is their individual case.
Okay.
There are not a lot of sure paths, but I think that's really the story. Your podcast is for boomers, and I think I'm a boomer, so I'm speaking to my peer group of boomers and saying that we've always kind of had to pave our own path as we went. When we were in our 20s, it was, I cite the example in the book of equal marriage. I got married in 1975, and my wife and I thought equal marriage sounded like a great idea. Practicing it, though, there was no guidebook. We were making it up as we went along. And I think a lot of our 20s in the boomer generation was making it up as we went along because we were different from what had come before, and we weren't necessarily satisfied with what had come before. And now here we are in our 60s and 70s, and it's the same story. Never in the history of the world as we know it has there ever been so many old people in the population, so many people our age. Traditionally, what you expect in a population is a triangle with lots and lots of children and young people at the bottom. And then gradually as you go older, you have fewer and fewer until at the very top of the pyramid, you have a few wise old crones and gentlemen and sages. And that's just not what's happening right now. Right now, worldwide, that pyramid looks more like a square with equal numbers of children and old people. This is new territory. Nobody's been there before. And we are feeling it out as we go, how to cope in a world where the needs of our own generation are going to have to take more attention from society than society has been built to do. It's a problem, but it's our problem, and we have a unique opportunity to shape it. So I think it's great that we have that opportunity.
Two thoughts is, first of all, I once wrote an article called "Where's the Surprise in the Baby Boomer Bulge?" Like we've known this was coming for like 60, 70 years. But just going back to your marriage, I had a theory that, as you say, equal marriage, that sort of thing, we women, we're all busy carving our path. We were in the trenches, so to speak, and I don't mean that literally. Whereas you men were just sort of going like, sounds like a good idea, but you had no role models for how to react to us. So, I mean, we're the busy ones. We're the busy bees because we're creating our path as we go and we're, making our stands and all the rest of it. So I will claim some, I won't say sympathy, empathy for the men of our generation who found themselves trying to be supportive, but the only role model they had for being a husband and a dad was their father, primarily.
Excellent. That's
So,
absolutely the case.
So in some ways it was easier for us women because, as I say, we were doing the busy work. We were creating that path. We were storming the castle sort of thing. But yeah.
Well, and one other thing about that, if I could, in terms of making the transition into an after-work life. Generally, women have less trouble, and the theory is that since throughout their whole lives they've been juggling multiple things at once, family and work and relationships and all of that, taking work away just removes one ball, and they continue juggling, and it's not as tough as it is for men who have concentrated on that one thing, and then that one thing goes away. So
Well, and I will also suggest that we women were often, if there was going to be a stay-at-home parent in our generation, it was the woman. So we were the ones, making the contacts on the school ground, any social activities that our children were involved in, all that sort of thing. So I know my social circle now still has a number of people from 35 years ago. When my kids were first starting to get into the school system and stuff like that.
sure.
So, whereas you men were busy being the worker bee primarily, and often, I'll be careful here, the primary provider of the family. So,
Well,
now, go ahead.
no, I was just going to make a smart aleck remark
Oh,
about
do
that.
it. I love those.
My wife was the breadwinner for most of our marriage,
Okay.
because of my zigzag potholed career. I often wasn't making a whole heck of a lot of money, whereas she, who is made of different stuff, stayed at one job for 28 years and was able to rise. And sock away a nice pension. So we did that part of the equal marriage correctly, I think. But I have to admit, she still is the social hub. She still is the relationship builder. She still keeps the family going. And while she would love more help from me, I'm not sure I have the instinct to do it as well as she does.
Part of that's learned. We had to learn. That's the only dig I'll put in, I promise. Now, with the economy the way it is in both your country and mine, bringing in some extra income seems to be a popular, shall I say, necessary goal. Did you find that amongst the people you interviewed?
Absolutely. For some people, it's an absolute necessity. Even with a governmental pension, people have to do gigs or short-term jobs or part-time work just to stay afloat. That's the case. It's also not as easy as just, well, I think I'll go get a job, because one of the real problems that we face is ageism. And it's very hard when you hit your 50s and 60s to get a fair shake from employers who talk all they want to about supporting employees and respecting the wisdom of older employees. But when it comes to hiring, the personnel department hasn't gotten the message somehow.
Age, I'm going to get to ageism. I have a question about ageism
All
later
right.
on, and I will leave it for later on. Now, I listened to talk radio quite a bit, and just this morning, I was listening to people discuss the fact that so many boomers now are actually being pressured. So it's not that they're volunteering, they're actually being pressured to help out grandchildren financially. Whether it's with education support, as jobs can be hard come by, even if it jeopardizes their own quality of life. Have you seen any of that?
I have, and I'm fortunate that my children are primarily self-sufficient, but we do help out with extras for the grandchildren. We help out with lessons and summer camps and things like that, and we don't mind, but if it got more serious, we would be compromised. In fact, someone who I know well has said that we're not even the sandwich generation. Sometimes we have our parents to care for too, so we're the club sandwich generation.
Good point. That's a good term. Yeah, I was going to say we're pretty much the financial umbrella sometimes, but no, and I got to be careful there. My children are also in the same boat where they're thank goodness, that they're financially independent and comfortably financially independent. I did meet someone recently who just stopped to talk on the street, and she was driving her grandchildren to their respective things. And they were in the back and they were nattering on at her. And I'm thinking, well, talk to your grandma that way. And she made the comment to me about she was really tired of paying for these extra activities and doing this. And she had felt the need just an hour before to remind these grandchildren that she could be on a really nice cruise. She could be driving a fancy car. She could be doing all sorts of things if she wasn't supporting them in these activities that they took for granted. Now, I must admit, I sort of suggest that she could forget to pay for the activities just for one session. I'm a bit of a hard love kind of parent. Yeah, it's sort of scary. And I mean, you love your grandchildren. You're not going to let them go without an education or, live on the street because they can't find a job.
Yeah, it's a very hard thing to determine. It's really a matter of communication between our generation and our children. And it is a communication that is very fraught with difficulty, I think, because they were raised in a different world than we were, even though we raised them. Our abundance may have been a problem because they take for granted what we never took for granted growing up, but we gave them all the opportunities, and so now they're thinking, well, that's what they deserved, and we should do the same. Gratitude is not something you can always expect, even though you think you deserve it. It's not always the way the children view the world, or at least that has been my experience.
Well, I think it's also safe to say that our children were the very first ones to grow up and say, "You need more money, just go to the machine."
Yes.
Not realizing that something had to put the money in the machine before you could take it out of the machine. You know, it was a strange concept, I'm sure, for children just to watch a parent walk up to a machine, push some buttons, and have the cash just spew out.
Right. What could be easier?
Yeah, bad example. dear. Now, you'd probably talk about your interviewees in the book. Can you tell us about a few of them? A few, were there any stories that stood out for you?
Oh, quite a number. I think one that stood out as a gentleman who he ended his career and decided that he would move across the country to be closer to his grandchildren. And he did. And then COVID hit, and he couldn't see his grandchildren except over Zoom. So, having turned his life around upside down and changed everything, he now found that he was no better off in terms of what he had come west to do, because of this unexpected occurrence. And there were other situations like that, people who planned retirement and then one spouse died, which leads me to say that no matter whether you plan in advance or you're the kind of person who just walks into a situation blind and tries to figure out where to go from there, you've got to be resilient and be prepared for surprises, because the afterwork comes at a time when we are going to be losing things. We're going to be losing friends. We're going to be losing functions in our body that we have grown rather accustomed and fond of. And so resilience is really important, because attitude is important and being positive about where you stand is important. And that helps resilience, and resilience reinforces that positivity. And clearly, research shows that being positive adds 7.5 years to your life. So we all want to be on that wagon.
Yeah, absolutely. It's interesting, you know, you talk about the person who moved across the country, wherever, moved a significant distance to be closer to the grandchildren. I live across town from my grandchildren, and I have to make an appointment with them because they're so busy. You know, they've got their activities, they've got their school, they've got their friends, they've got birthday parties on the weekend, that sort of thing. You know, that sort of a concept has to be discussed, I would say, before you sort of think, oh, it'll be wonderful to live so close to the grandchildren. You know, as I say, I live cross town and I have to make an appointment. I don't see them all that much, and I never see them unless I make an appointment. So, and that's, you know, we are all very close. So I'm, you know, that's sort of the good side of that story. Now, the other part, you mentioned a spouse who dies. You know, statistics prove that the man will die sooner than the woman, usually. With our generation still, and with all deference to your amazing wife, oftentimes it was the man that took care of all the financials, the investments, the retirement plans, all that sort of thing. And I think both of these examples comes down to communication. You know, where now, and I've had people on, like financial advisors on the podcast, who say, you know, we say, like, whoever is the managing person in the family, the other person needs to get involved, at least to have some basic understanding and to know the financial advisor.
That is so true.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's just so hard if that spouse dies and suddenly you're going, okay, I'm not even sure where all the bank accounts are, let alone investments and what they mean and what returns are and all that different stuff, you know.
Yeah.
So
Well, my wife and I have been saying that we're going to put a booklet together for the children so that if both of us go, they have some idea. We've been saying that for at least 9 or 10 months, and we haven't done it yet. But it's always there, and we do have the intention of doing it for just that reason. And I've been the mostly the numbers guy, but she asked me to show her how I did it, and so we've had sessions where we work together on the numbers, and so she has some fair idea of how it's laid out and what we've got. And we could do better, but we are aware, that could be an issue, and we don't want to burden our children with trying to become detectives to figure out where the assets are.
You hear that story time and time again, you know, from, and I actually just, well, I went through it on the sidelines with a friend who was handling an estate. And it was like, oh, wait a minute, the husband died 14 years ago, but that still hasn't been settled, you know, so you can't settle the wife's estate, you know, like all, there's just so many bits and pieces that, unless, as you say, there's a guidebook, you know, as things come up now at this age, I tend to, I don't discuss it with my children, but I inform them. And they certainly know who my financial advisor is, that sort of thing. So I should probably do what you and your wife are talking about doing in terms of writing it all down. Because the other side of that coin is when you're in grief, I hope they'll be in grief when I go. When you're in grief, it's really hard to think clearly and think, okay, they said that the financial advisor was this person, I got to contact them. You know, it's really hard to do all that.
I'm sure. Yeah, that's why I'm a fan of writing it down because perhaps all children are this way, but my children in particular, if you say it, it disappears into the ether. You have to write it down. And I think it's more helpful to them. Then they don't have to scratch their memory banks and try to remember who that financial planner is. It's on paper somewhere with a phone number.
And I think a lot of times too, and once again, I'm fortunate insofar as I had a career in elder care. And when you work in residential elder care, I don't mean this as coldly as it sounds, everybody dies. And so my children were brought up on the edge of that, and I would make them volunteer, but with things and all sorts of stuff. So they know that death is going to happen. So if I ever use the term when I'm dead and gone, or, you know, like any of that stuff that suggests I'm going to die at some point in time, I also have a phrase that says I'm going to live forever and so far so good. But they don't squirm, because I do hear a lot of people say to their parents, oh, it's you've got years. We'll talk about that next decade or something, you know, and you just never know when you're going to get hit by the proverbial bus.
My mother, who was not wise in all things, was very wise on that one. She got all four of the siblings together in a room and said, "Now that I have you here, I want you to decide who gets what of the things. I don't have a lot, but we need to decide." And we all said, "Oh, that's ridiculous." But we did it. And it's a good thing we did because she then came down with dementia. And we spent 7 years with that. And if we had not had that exercise before, it would have been real chaos. So it was a good move on her part.
It's and you just need a few examples of that for people to go like, you know, because as I say, you never think that you're going to get hit by a bus. You never say, oh, when I get dementia, you know, those sorts of things, they sneak up on you. So
Right.
now, going back to your interviewees, did any of them have unique stories about how they implemented whatever they decided to do next?
One of them has actually written a book that I find pretty remarkable. It's called Tapas Life. And his suggestion was that when you are after your career, it's not going to be clear exactly what you should do next, so why not get a small plate sampler of different activities and mix them? And so he suggested, well, I do 10 hours of volunteering here, and I joined a board of this nonprofit and this. And then if you feel uncomfortable with any of them, discard that plate, pick up another plate until you have what feels like a really good balance. And I thought that was a really brilliant way to look at it.
Yeah, and we also, for the most part, come from a generation of commitment. So, like, if we sort of say, oh, I'm going to volunteer wherever, like however many hours a week, it's really hard to say, this is not fun. I don't feel like I'm being productive, any of that sort of stuff, to actually say, give your notice to a volunteer organization and say, thank you, but I will be concluding my work with you in a month or something. It's really hard to, especially when they're nonprofits and things like that. But what a
Right.
great idea.
Yeah, I thought it made perfect sense.
And
Really
even
did.
looking at, for people who need that extra money or want the extra money, to give that part-time, whatever it is, a job or a new career or business, whatever it is, to test the water. And if it's a new business, try not to invest too much money in it if you're not sure. But same thing, like suddenly you're going like, okay, somebody made a joke just recently about being the greeter at Walmart. And I said, do not joke. I think that would be almost the ideal post-work job. You get to chat to people, you get to wander around and stack up buggies. You go home at the end of the day and you don't even give it a thought. So it really suited the
Yeah.
social butterfly in me.
I think a lot of people would really like that kind of work because obviously, especially for those who are going it solo, I mean, isolation and lack of social contact is a real risk factor for dementia and for just falling apart. Social connections really make a huge difference in how long we live and how well we do.
No, for sure. I did meet a Walmart greeter, 25, 30 years ago now. And he was an older gentleman and he just loved to write children's stories. But the being part-time at Walmart gave him the income that allowed him to write his children's stories, even if nobody read them but his own grandchildren. So it just seemed like, that perfect sort of thing. And we should all be so lucky as to find something that, if we need the money, brings in the money, we can enjoy it for whatever reason, and then it gives us whatever we need to do the stuff that we're passionate about.
Exactly. And some people have turned their passions into productive income producers too. And it's not for everybody to do that. In my own case, I'm producing income, but it's just about enough income to buy two chai latte. So I have just enough to buy two a day, and that's my income. It's not great, but it gives me some measure that I'm doing something constructive for the family budget. And in the meantime, I'm not doing it for the money. I'm doing it for the fun. And I think that, as you say, people can have a part-time job and still pursue their hobby, whether it's playing the piano or carving duck decoys or whatever it happens to be. And then if it turns into an income producer, well, all the better.
Yeah, and I know several people that really like doing something, and I say, like, there's a market for this if you ever wanted to do that. And some of them say, that's interesting. Some of them say, oh, I couldn't do that, like, or my stuff just isn't good enough. There's all sorts of responses that come out of things. But yeah, people are incredibly inventive and creative and stuff like that. So.
Well, and I've also known a man who said that he monetized his hobby, and then it became so businesslike that it took the fun out of it, and he decided that he didn't want to do that anymore, and he went back to doing it for fun. But that's success is the least of your problems. You should be so fortunate to be successful, and then you can decide what to do.
My brother's a woodworker, and he's also a perfectionist, which means the pieces he creates, built, whatever, are beautiful. So he's got a regular clientele, but he has his boundaries. He goes like, no, summer's coming on, so I'm going to be camping. I'm going to be out with the dog, all that sort of stuff. So we should all be so lucky as to A, be able to make money off of something we really love doing, but also have those boundaries. So it's yeah.
Yeah, that's ideal.
What haven't we talked about that makes your book and your research a must read?
I think we've talked about a lot of it, but I think the main thing to get across is that the retirement that we used to know does not exist anymore and doesn't make sense for people. And because of longevity, we have this gift of additional years that if we're positive about it and look at it as an opportunity, can be a really great time, where our responsibilities to family and such are much less than they used to be, where our need to produce income to support the family is not a big factor anymore. And really it can be just good me time where we get to enjoy activities that we love for their own sake. And so I think that's my book is really on trying to convince people that this is a really good time to be alive, and that there's quite a bit more time to do it and to enjoy it.
Okay, and we used the big word earlier in our conversation, and I said it was in my notes, just briefly, ageism. I mean, there's external and there is internal. What are your thoughts on ageism?
It is probably more the internal ageism that is our problem. And I think it's the internal ageism that causes us to feel defeated by the insults of our body not doing what it's supposed to do anymore, our parts failing, of feeling invisible. All of that is really more our own feeling of being old and the social construct in which being old is a bad thing. This is we live in a time when the cultural values salute youth and beauty, and we have so signed on to these values that we try to preserve our youth and our beauty for many years past their expiration date, and we feel bad that we're not young. And that's a ridiculous thing on the face of it, but it's programmed into our heads. And we need to try to shake that and say, I am this age, I am old, and I'm proud of it. And it doesn't mean I'm useless. I still have thoughts, I still have ideas, I still have drive, I still have creative things that can be of use to people. And when we go out with that attitude, age becomes a much more enjoyable state of being.
And we have wisdom now, and I'm not blowing our own horn, but boy, to be able to look back on just the things that have happened in our own life, whether personally or in the world, is just, I'm very fortunate to have a 15-year-old grandson that will come to me and say, "Well, what do you think about this, Grandma?" Or like that sort of thing, because he knows that I know what was going on in the 70s, and even to a
Yeah,
certain extent in the 60s,
that's
so.
great. Well, and the height of wisdom I have found is never offering your views unless you've been invited to do so.
Guilty as charged.
Yeah, well, you
There's
know.
times, there's time. I mean, I do try to keep my mouth shut for the most part, but no, there's times when it's just like.
I've learned from hard experience that sort of advice and wisdom is never as received in the way that you hoped it would land. And So I just keep my mouth zipped. And then if somebody asks me, I'll tell them what I think. But
I
until
must admit,
then,
I never offer it with my kids because I think, no,
well, that's mostly what I was thinking about. Yeah.
Where do we find you on the World Wide Web?
I have a website. It's donakchion.com, and it's spelled DonakChin.com. And my book is available on Amazon. If you just search on the title, The Afterwork, Finding Fulfilling Alternatives to Retirement, you will find it. And I hope you do.
Okay, you also have a newsletter.
Yes, that is on Substack.
Oh, so I was going to ask, is it the same thing? So we can sign up either at your website or follow you at Substack.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, that's it's called The End Game, and I put something out weekly, and it's free unless you decide to be a supporter, which I'd be happy for you to do, but it's not necessary.
Yeah, we're all there. Okay, can I ask you a personal question before we close?
Absolutely.
Now, I do not mean this as an insult. If anything, it proves that I've been reading your Substack. Are you old?
Yes, I am 74.
And you think that's old?
I do, but you know, my wife and I celebrated our 50th anniversary a couple months ago, and as I said then, I don't understand this because I thought by the time you celebrate your 50th anniversary, you're in a wheelchair or you're using a cane or a walker, and I'm not doing any of those things. But that was my idea of how somebody who'd been married for 50 years was supposed to look. So I'm old, but my idea of what old is changing.
Okay.
Somebody said if you ask somebody when does old age start, they will always tell you 5 years past their own age.
Or more.
Well, something like
dear.
that, yeah.
Just the older I get, the more I meet people who say, this is old. I'm old. It's all good. I tend to call it mid-age because I was born. I'm not dead yet. So I'm somewhere in the middle.
Yeah.
But I'm going to use some of your terms here. Own your age.
Absolutely.
Age is more a state of mind.
Very true.
I think I am not, therefore I am not. So I'm going to call you on your own words there. And one thing I really liked, and it really hits home, and perhaps part of our conversation has summed this up, is chronology is not a good measure of old age. Age is more a state of mind.
I think that's absolutely the case.
Yeah. Good thing, because you wrote
Well, I hope so.
it.
I hope
No,
I'm
because I
being
think,
honest.
yeah. Well, it's just that we all know people who, at 50, you go like, oh my God, like what happened to you? Like they're old and maybe even younger than that, they're old. And yet we all know those old people that are still full of life. I mean, even if they are in a wheelchair, they're full of life. They've got some attitude, they got opinions, they've got dreams, they're funny, like all that sort of stuff.
Those are the people I really respect, because I've been around curmudgeons too, and I respect people who have a zest for living right up until their last moments. It's courageous, and it's also really the right way to do life, as I see it.
I will agree with that. Okay, your website link is in the show notes. All of your links, the book, the Substack, everything, they're all on your page on our website.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Listeners, you probably are somewhere in the midst of want to leave the 9 to 5, or if I made some extra money, I'd be able to take that trip, or what shall I do so I'm not the taken for granted babysitter for my darling grands? Or perhaps the worst, I started talking to the TV. I need life. Talk to us. Leave comments where you're listening, or if you're listening at boomwithabang.com, scroll to the bottom of the page and talk to us there. What did Don and I not touch on? Tell me in the comments and I'll get your response. Share this episode. You are well aware that you'll probably be living longer than your grandparents. That's a good thing. And another good thing is socializing. So share this episode with a friend or two and then plot some hijinks together. And if you're going to plot hijinks, feel free to send me an invite. If you enjoyed this conversation, click the follow button at your favorite podcast platform. It helps us grow. I'm also registered at Substack. Following there is free, and you'll get notified every time an episode is released. A reminder to check out the resource tab at boomwithabang.com. You can look up previous podcast episodes by subject. You can find books written by guests, including today's, some interesting courses and offerings, and just coincidentally, in keeping with Don and my conversation today, there are lists of age-appropriate job and philanthropic possibilities. Also, if you're at all curious about the life of a house slash pet sitter, I'm journaling that journey on the website too. Don Auction, thank you for being my guest today and reminding us that there are lots of ways to fill these extra decades, and we are done with the adulting that was necessary throughout our life, and how important it is to do something, to embrace these last years, I think it's safe to say.
Thank you, Agnes. This was a delightful conversation, and I'm glad we had it.
Yeah, me too. Thank you. Have a great rest of week.